Since we've all been eating ice cream, this is one that my mother told me about. My sister and I lived up here when we were little girls, and the ice cream parlor was popular then, too. And my sister, who was 3 years older than me, must have been maybe around 7 or 8, and she felt very big and important and thought she could go in and order her ice cream. So Mom let her go in, and the ice cream she wanted was Tutti Frutti. And she went in and she said to the man behind the counter, "I want some of that Rudy Toot Toot ice cream." And later he told my mom, and he said, "She was so cute asking, I couldn't embarrass her, so I just dipped up the ice cream."
That was Joy Ham Malmstrom. Okay, I'm Linda Powell Jensen. The campfire girls used to take turns being the keeper of the key to go down and light the fire early in the evening to have the stove going so it was warm when we started our meetings, and usually you did it for a month, and so you kept the key for a month. And one fall when we lived here, Jerry Sheldon's dad shot a young bear, and his folks had gone to Lucerne on Saturday night, and I don't remember if we'd been out playing kick the can, what we'd been doing, but anyway, we decided that Jerry suggested maybe we had to try eating some bear meat. And so he decided to go to his house to get bear meat, and we decided that we would cook it at the campfire cabin because I had the key. So we went to the campfire cabin, but there's no cooking utensils in the campfire cabin, so we just cooked it on top of the wood stove. Actually, the bear meat was pretty good. It was a young bear. I think Jerry got in trouble because my recollection is that he actually just, you know, he went and grabbed some out of the refrigerator, but he took some of the pretty prime cuts. But what Linda learned was that I spent all day Sunday cleaning that stove because it stuck all over, and we had campfire Monday night, and I had to get the bear meat cleaned off the stove. So that was one of our fun activities, but also had another side to it. And I'm sure some of you others had some interesting pranks to talk about that you did, too. So, Mary Joy, I know you recorded it today, but why don't you come and tell the story again about meeting Ferd, because it's a fun one.
I'm Mary Joy Holzhauser, psych, and we lived here a long time, and I was a teenager, and when we went out to school in Wenatchee, we were a little bit longer getting back in 1956. But as we got off the bus at the same place where we get on and off the bus now, Rayma, stand up, Rayma, Rayma Paulson Weaver now, came running up with her arms flailing and said, "There are a whole bunch of college boys here, and there's one left." Well, so I'd like to introduce my husband, the one left. This is Ferd Syke, and and we've been married 49 years.
It will never last. It will never last. Now my version. I don't know who Mary Joy was. I didn't know who Mary Joy was. I don't even remember meeting her. And really, I guess I did. But the clincher was one day I went into the post office to collect my mail, hoping there would be some. And her father, dear Al, said to me, he said, "How would you like a home-cooked meal of roast beef?" Well, that sounded good. I really enjoyed the meals that were fixed for the miners, though, because they were really tremendous. And I said, "Well, okay, I guess that'd be all right." Well, I've been a member of that family ever since. But the interesting thing was we had to watch a slideshow. Now, how many of you knew Al and his camera? Anyone in here? I mean, he took more pictures than you can possibly imagine, and he had thousands and thousands of slides. And some of the best ones were the snow slides. You want to explain that, dear? Those were where he was flipping through the canister, you know, going around in the projector, and it'd come up on a blank spot, and another blank spot, and another blank spot. Those were the snow slides.
Well, as you know, I'm Rima Paulson Weaver, and the other night Linda was telling about raiding gardens, and I don't quite recall the one she was talking about, but I know that we slept out a lot, and it was so neat, and the one time we slept out up in our yard and come late at night, I don't remember, Mary Jo, I'm sure, was there, and Larissa probably, Linda, I don't know. Anyway, we went garden raiding, and we went down the road behind Russians, I think it was, in that general area. And we managed to rip up the garden. They must have been absolutely horrified when they looked out, because we walked by there the next day, or I did, and there was just a big long trail of cabbages and carrot tops and lettuce and I don't know what all. We just raised havoc with that garden. And I know we raided gardens 3 or 4 times.
Well, I'm Thread Powell, and one winter my dad bought a flying saucer from Thread Wigger he had in his store. Well, before I got it, he decided to try it out on Shelby Hill. And he came in the house, and his hat was this way, and his glasses was this way, and it was this way, and one strap hanging, and he said, "Man, that thing really goes. That kid will kill himself on that." And I never got to play with it.
Been a long and arduous day, but I have a lot of memories from living up here. My name's Jerry Paulson. Raymond's my older sister. Joanna is my lovely younger sister. My lovely wife is back here joining me. This is the first time I've been to a reunion, and I was up to Holden in 1960 after a trip over the pass down this way, and then again in 63 just to visit. Other than that, I haven't been around here, but coming up here really brings back a lot of memories and a lot of stories. But the other night, somebody was talking about their first experience with, I can't remember if it was just vandalism or breaking the law or whatever, but I started my criminal activity here as well. I was in the Boy Scouts. We had a wonderful scout master. His name was Jim Sullivan. You probably all remember Jim. We learned a lot from him, and he would take us out and teach us survival in the woods and just basically how to get along and how to enjoy the outdoors and be nice to the outdoors. And he's an ex-Marine, so he also taught us things like close order drill and to call him sir and things like that. But on this one occasion, he took 12 boys up to Domke Lake early in the season. It was in late June, he took 12 boys up there for a camperette, actually, and we got up there, we got our camp set up, and now Gordon Stewart, y'all remember Gordon Stewart, he didn't really like House Sounders, he didn't like House Sounders, but he tolerated them, and he especially didn't like the ones that kept their boats up there, and I didn't know a great deal about that, but it was my turn to clean up our scout camp. And all the other guys got in the two boats that we had rented from Gordon, that Jim had rented from Gordon. And they would go off fishing and left me back there to clean up the dishes and clean up camp. And Don Davidson was my good friend, and Rob Davidson, his younger brother. And they had a little brother named David Davidson. He was too young to be a scout, but he tagged along with us everywhere because, as you all well remember, the Davidsons were a pretty tough bunch, and you couldn't keep David from joining in. So it was my lot to clean up camp and keep track of David Davidson. So after we got camp cleaned up, we decided we'd go try to find a place to fish from the shore. And I took my trusty scout axe and David and fishing pole, and we started hiking north along the shore. And lo and behold, we came upon a boat, turned upside down in the brush, an abandoned boat. Can you imagine our elation? So we looked under it, and sure enough, there were oars in that, and that was all we needed. We turned it over and started dragging that boat down to the beach, and it was chained to a tree. But no problem. I had my belt axe with me. So I chopped the chain dutifully, as any young scout would do, and we pushed the boat in the water and rowed away and fished and had a good time, just two of us uncrowded in this boat while the other boys were crowded in the other two boats. We came by Jim, and he shouted, "Where'd you guys get that boat?" I said, "Well, we found it up on the shore, up there in the weeds." We didn't lie. We found it in the weeds. I didn't tell him about the chain, but so he says, "Well, you make sure it gets back when you're done with it." So we did. And we went back, and we were up there for about another 2-3 days, and we had three boats with 12 guys, so it made it real convenient. Come day we were going to leave, it was a Sunday, we were heading back home, and Jim and a couple of the other boys were taking the boats down to turn them back into Gordon. The rest of the scouts were starting down the trail. My responsibility, and David's essentially, was to take this boat back where we found it, make sure everything was fine. So we did. We took it back sort of where we found it and kind of drug it up on the shore and threw the chain at the tree, and everything was fine. Well, during the next week, the water came up a little bit, being spring and a runoff there, late June. And I was coming home from church the next Sunday and was walking up the road with Mike Rushen and Donnie Bryant. And my dad came down the road in his car, and we all waved, "Hey, Dad, hi, how you doing?" You know, because everything was fine, sunny day, and I could tell. He says, "You get home. I'm going to talk to you." And boy, I'll tell you, for the life of me, I don't know why, but whenever my dad was mad at me like that, I ran home. Today it doesn't make sense, but I ran home, and he got there, and boy, I'll tell you what, I was in big trouble. He was a strong believer in corporal punishment, and one of the things after I got in trouble, and etc., he gave me 50 cents or a piece of tin, and he said, "Now I'm going to take you down to the bus, He said, "You're going to go down to Lucerne. You're going to hike into Domke Lake." Because what had happened was the boat had drifted out in the lake. And Gordon Stewart, being a fine naval person that he was, commandeered it and claimed it as salvage. And the boat belonged to Calvin Carver, of all people, and Mike Defoe. Now, Mike is a pretty cool guy. I knew his daughter, Cheryl, sort of. And she was a classmate. Gordon wouldn't let them have their boat back, of all things. And Cal was ballistic. Anyway, he said, "Then you're going to walk in, and you're going to go up and ask Gordon if you can tell him what you did, and ask him if he'll please let those guys have their boat back." And I was mortified. I could have been more than 10, 11 years old. And, you know, that's severe punishment, because it was in the afternoon. And so I did. I mean, I had no choice. I did. Rode down the bottom of the hill, hiked into Domke Lake, went to Gordon Stewart, hanging my head, told him what I'd done. And I think I got a worse chewing from Gordon Stewart than from my dad. I don't know how many of you knew Gordon or knew him well, but he was a very honest, upstanding individual. He was also pretty single-minded about certain things, and thievery wasn't in his book of tolerable offenses. So he chewed me out good, and then he said, "Okay, you know, you go back and tell your dad to talk to me, and I'll give Mike back his boat." So I turn around, hike back down the trail, and I got down to Lucerne. It was like about 7 o'clock, and it's starting to get dark. I'm thinking, how am I going to get back up to Holden? Well, the only thing to do is walk up. It's only 12 miles. So the other day in one of these sessions, somebody was trying to remember the name. There was a single guy, I think, maybe he was married, but he was an Italian, and he had black hair, and he was pretty sophisticated drinker, and he drove a 49 Studebaker, and I can't remember his name, But he was a nice enough fellow for a miner, and he came sliding around the corner coming back to Holden from the tavern, and I was on about the second switchback, and he slid to a stop. His headlights hit me, and he slid to a stop there, and he said, "What the world are you doing down here, boy?" So I told him what I was doing, and he said, "You get in a car, I'll take you home." And I remember clearly wondering if I really should get in the car, because the guy was obviously pretty well oiled, and I didn't know him very well, but I got in the car, and he drove me home, and my mom was so happy to see me. My mom was the kind of wife and mother that really didn't say anything about Dad's discipline, so I had to do what Dad said, but she was really happy to see me home. My dad, on the other hand, said, "How in the world, well, that was my word, how in the world did you get home so quickly?" And I just said, "Oh, I hitchhiked." I got in trouble all over again for hitchhiking.
We lived at the top of, my name is Jose Jimenez. My name is Rich Robertson, then known as Dick Robertson. And we lived in Holden two different times, and we lived here in three different houses. My dad built two houses. One up in Winston Camp, and then we moved out when he worked for Boyles Brothers Drilling Company, and we went to Colorado, Utah, Montana. Came back, and he built another house up there, and we lived there for a while. And then John Bly, I think, was the foreman of the mine, and he moved on or went to another position, so my dad became mine foreman. So we moved down to the Circle with the management families, and we were in house number 7, I believe. 9, up at the top, and we had, it was the highest spot in the Circle, and off our front porch was a toboggan run, and they had big high banks along the road going up there, and they were probably 6-7 feet high and pretty icy and all, but we had these toboggan runs, and Jim Sullivan, who was the scoutmaster and very wonderful person, had two well-known people come here to visit him over Christmas one time. Lou Whitaker and his brother Jim Whitaker. You remember Jim Whitaker is the first American to climb Mount Everest. And so the three of them came down to go tobogganing with us off our front porch and all of that up there. And so we got the toboggans and a whole bunch of us were doing that. And I remember Jim Whitaker had his arms wrapped around me, and my brother, I think, was behind Jim, and I thought, this is the first guy to climb Mount Everest, and he's got his arm around me, and we're about to go off my front porch, and who knows what was going to happen. But anyway, we did, and we tried to get down there, and never once made it to the bottom, and Bill was there, and there was a whole bunch of us, and we were all trying to get to the bottom. We kept crashing off all of these sides and never quite made it, but fortunately, at that point, nobody had gotten hurt. Well, the last run that we came down, there were two people walking up the hill. And I didn't know who they were. I couldn't see them way down there and stuff. And I thought, oh, they'll just go in one of the little doorways there while we come crashing down and won't be a problem. So we all got in. There must have been probably four of us on the big toboggan. And we start off down the hill, and we're going bang, bang across like this. And the two people hadn't gone in, and they were right in front of us, and we hit them and knocked them down, and it turned out it was my parents. And my poor mother was was quite bruised and quite hurt and the whole thing, and my dad was so mad he could hardly talk to me. So that was kind of the end of the tobogganing and all. But fortunately, we got them up the rest of the way up the hill, and nobody suffered very long from that. But that was my story.
Many of you know I volunteer up here during the summer, and the first year I came, Rick asked me if I would be interested in doing a program to take people up through the miners' village to talk about what it was like living there as a kid and kind of decide what, describe what the houses and looked like in our yards and things. And so over the couple of summers, I've developed a program, and we go on up and walk, and we stop different places, and I tell about different things at the various stops along the way, including talking about some of the camp characters. And one of the stories I tell that they seem to remember, because sometimes people come back and says, oh, you're the lady that tells the toboggan story. And some of you older people won't be aware of this, but, you know, we had those bazaars, and they had all those wonderful raffle items that they gave away at the bazaars. And I believe it was the fall of 54, or because I think it was the last year that we were here, they had a beautiful toboggan that was being raffled off at the bazaar. And I'm telling you, all of us kids, every dime of babysitting money was going there, because whoever won that toboggan was going to be queen of the hill or king of the hill. And when they drew the ticket that night, the name they drew was Chubby Merrill. So we're all waiting for her, since she has no children, to tell them to draw another ticket. And I'm telling you, I can remember her face as clear as day. She had this big grin. She picked that toboggan up and put it under her arm, and she hauled it out of that door. And we never saw that toboggan again. And the kids tell me they don't remember seeing it the next winter either. So I feel, because some of you know, I think she's the one that tried to set her house on fire when they announced that mine was closed. So when we go down that road, I tell people, and here lie the ashes of the toboggan. That's what I tell them.
Well, I think that this evening is one where people should be telling on each other. This is a time to maybe get even with folks. I don't know, or whatever. My name is Jerry Johansson, and I did not grow up at Holden. I first visited Holden in 1969, but it's been my pleasure to come out here, and especially come out here this week with all of you. Some of you perhaps know that Linda has a tremendous program that I think is just really awesome, which she calls Bridging Two Communities. And she talks about things that were happening in mining days and the way things happen here. And it's come to me today on a very serious note that perhaps this place molds people rather than people molding this place. It's a pretty awesome place. But her telling the toboggan story makes me think of the winter of, I believe it was 2003, Linda. Yeah, she said she had never, Rich, she had never been down the hill the way you guys did. And she said, I'm going to go down this hill. And she was up here working like crazy. I was scanning stuff, working like 18, 20 hours a day. She says,
came on vacation,
yeah, she came on vacation, and she was a paying guest, but she worked about 12 hours a day, let me tell you, up in the cold museum, unheated. But she said, we're taking a break, and I'm going to go down that hill. So she started up, not as far as you guys lived, but about halfway up, and she came zipping down on a sled, came across the road, hit the big drift over here, and ended up upside down in the middle of the road, of which I do have a video of somewhere at home. But I thought, you know, I would just start off telling some things. You don't have to tell nasty things about people, but there's, I'm sure, some really funny things. But that, to me, is bridging two communities, because you guys did lots of tobogganing.
Well, Gail's coming up here. Jerry doesn't know that in the mining days, that was all plowed out and had a long run, and I didn't think
Well, before I get into the how I met my husband here, I wanted to tell just two quick things. I'm sorry, Gail Rogers Davidson. Yes, one of the Davidson Rogers tribe, as we were called or known up here. I remember when I was 8 years old, we were free to go and come as nobody ever asked. You didn't have to go say, Mom, can I do nothing? You know, just go do it. And I started to walk up towards the mine and mill, and I saw the tailings, and I thought, that's gold. And I ran back and got my wagon and a shovel, and I filled that wagon with the tailings and come running home with it and pulled in the backyard, and I said, Daddy, Daddy, I found gold. And then, you know, we always hear the tale of the rainbow, you know, and if you find the end where it goes in, you've got a pot of gold. And I was walking up that, the trail where, or the road where the ore trucks went, and I saw a rainbow, and I kept looking, and it went right into the muck on the right side. And I thought, I've got to go. There's a pot of gold there. And I stepped down into it about up to my knees, and I got home and got in an awful lot of trouble. Plus, it was pretty scary not being able to get out. Okay, so then one story about my dad. I know you all knew D.A. Rogers. One time, of course, it was, you weren't supposed to have liquor, but there was plenty of it here, and my dad knew. And he got really, really drunk, I guess. And he put on my mother's corset and ran around the campsite and knocked on doors. That's a true story. And, I happened to come up in a February. I was a junior in high school in Chelan, and I came up in February to go to the March of Dimes dance that was held in this gymnasium. And I'm not into dancing, but Mother said, well, you're here. I want you to go. So I went, and there was not very many people here, but my husband, I saw Ari Davidson. He said, hey, you stay right here. I've got somebody I want you to meet. And he ran downstairs to the rec hall, and he got Bob, and he came up, and he said, this is my brother, Bob, and I want you to, he introduced us. Well, that was about all that was said, and I come wandering in here and sat in a chair over in that corner, and pretty soon, here comes Bob, and he asked me to dance. Oh, my gosh, that's like pushing a broom on a floor with me, you know. But we danced, and he asked if he could walk me home. And it was freezing cold, snow, you know. He walked me home, and, yes, he kissed me. And he said, would you come up to my brother's house tomorrow and watch television? Well, my goodness, I hadn't seen television. Ari Davidson put the reflector on this mountain so people could have television. And I was so thrilled. Oh, I showed right up on time. I knocked on the front door. I don't know how many of you knew Peggy, who was going to be my sister-in-law later. She was the town grouch, you know. And I knocked on the door, and she opened the door, and she says, what? I said, Bob asked me if I could come up and watch television. And she said, oh, he's not here, but come in. And so I'm just sitting on the couch just cowering, and she went back into her kitchen, and about that time her four boys walked in, and Bob right behind him, and he smiled and said hi, and he went right in the kitchen. He says to Peggy, who is that? She said, well, you better know, you invited her here. And we just started dating, and in a year and a half we were married, and both of our children were born here. So that's my story.
came. My name's Pat Handel Chandra. I'm John and Elizabeth's daughter. I don't know, up until now I kind of thought everybody was normal, but now I'm beginning to wonder. I'll get to the end of it, but I want to tell my polywog story, and some of you already heard it, but I don't know if any of you remember Susan Talon. She was Les and June Talon's, one of Les and June Talon's daughters. And Susie and I would run around together and do things together. We were never bored. We never lacked for anything to do. What one didn't think of, the other did. Well, Dad had a tree stump out back that he hollowed out in the center, and he made me a bird bath, and he put my name in it and the date. And we filled it with water, and it was supposed to be for the birds. Well, it was for the birds. Nobody ever used it. And so one day, Susan and I were out hiking. I think we were kind of where we weren't supposed to be, a little bit further, but we weren't in any danger. But on our way back, we walked by the polywog pond, and I don't know how many people remember where that was at. It was like the ballpark. You go to the picnic ground, and there's just kind of this little area where seep water came in or something. It was kind of marshy and stuff. And we saw a bunch of polywogs in there, so we got this idea. We're going to catch them and take them home and grow frogs. So I went home and I asked Mom for a couple of cups, and she said, well, you're certainly not going to get the good cups that we drink out of here at home. You can have some paper cups. And she said, what are you going to use them for? And I says, catch polywogs. And so she just kind of smiled and didn't say another word. And Susan went down, she got some paper cups, and so we go up to the polywog part, or the polywog pond, and Mom says, now don't get your clothes dirty. And June was always telling Susan that. Well, the minute Susan got up and she was all cleaned up, she was dirty. It was just the way we were, but I was a little bit more the needy-peedy. So anyway, we went out on this raft, and we were there, and we were scooping polywogs, and we were catching quite a few of them, catching them, and we were putting them in another cup and stuff, and all of a sudden, it's like our cups fell apart. And Susan and I wanted some more polywogs. And so we looked at each other and we thought, well, we'll use our hands to catch and kind of make them a cup of it and get the polywogs out. And so we did that for a while, but in the process, we fell in. And we finally got enough polywogs and we kind of got dried off and we went home, and all Mom could see was I was dirty. Susan went home, what's new? You know, Susan. And so we put our polywogs out back in the little bird bath thing. Bright and early the next morning, and this is not wasn't typical of Susan and I. We got up early, but this was, I mean, like the crack of dawn. We go out there, check on our polywogs. And Dad hadn't gone to work yet, and I went in the house, and I said, where did the polywogs go? Dad says, well, they grew up and hopped away. Susan comes up, she looks in the pond, she doesn't see any, and she says, what happened to the polywogs? And I says, the cats got them. Now, here's the really neat part. Laura Grove. I was walking up the sidewalk the other night, or last night, or something like that, and I found out who made the raft. And I'm thinking, should I thank him or what? Because we fell in. It turned out to be Riley Tyler and Jerry Paulson. So that was it.
I wish Darlene Levitt were still here because I want to tell a story on her. But this is about the polywog pond where Riley and I lived most of our lives. Doug was up there a lot. Don Davidson, Donnie Bryant, all his kids. Polywog pond was seepage from the creek, and creek. And it was about 2 feet deep, and it was stagnant, and it was there all summer long. And it was a vile place. The mud was about probably 6 inches deep in the bottom of it, but, you know, kids, we liked that. And there were some planks up there. So we built this raft so we could get out on the polywog pond because there were frogs out there and polywogs, you know, and we put fish, we catch little fish, and we put the little fish in there too. So it was alive. So we drug these planks over. Well, the polywog pond was like this big. And the raft was like this big. It was more like a floating bridge. You pull it onto one side, you could get on it, and then you'd pull it about like 10 feet and hit the other side when the water was really low. But it was still our raft, and we could spin it around, and we played pirates up there and everything. Well, on this one, Labor Day, you remember we used, or 4th of July it was. Remember they always, the company 4th of July picnics. Oh, all the ice cream and pop the kids could drink. Well, after lunch, Riley and I had gone up to the polywog pond just for something to do, and it was hot, and Riley says, I'm going for a swim. And I said, well, I don't have my swimming suit. And Riley said, well, I don't either, but we don't need it. We'll just go in our underwear. And he was stripping his clothes off, and he had, you know, tidy whitey underwear on, and he just went right out there on, waded out and got up on the raft, and he was playing around out there, and he lost his balance, and he fell off the raft. And I remember he fell backwards because he was absolutely covered with water. I mean, he went clear under the water. And he got up, and he was just laughing, and he was covered with mud and slime and stuff. But his underwear was like, it wasn't the best quality of underwear, you understand? So it was hanging way down here, and he'd pull it up, but the legs were like big, and wasn't a lot of covering on. Well, coming up the road behind us was Mrs. Levitt and her three darling daughters, Jeannie and Terry and Darlene. And they all had these very, very proper and beautiful little frocks on. I remember Jeannie's was yellow, and I think Terry's was blue, and I don't remember what Darlene had on. But they were all walking like something out of Mikado, you know, Pity Sing and Yum Yum and Pretty Little Girls up there. And I remember it so clearly because she came around the corner. I was standing on the side of the pond. I was totally embarrassed and scared because here was Levitt's and the girls coming up there. And I always wanted to look good for the girls. And Riley's out there in his what's left of his underwear, is covered with mud, laughing like a crazy man, falling backwards in the water. And Mrs. Levitt goes, looks at that and says, come, girls.
My name's Gwen Kautz, and I am Bob and Gail Davidson's firstborn daughter. And I know you're thinking, what does she remember about living here? Because I was 2 when we left. And I don't remember a lot. I remember a couple of small things, but one of the things that I know is my whole life I have grown up with my folks have given me the legacy of Holden. And it came not just from them, but also from my grandmother, Anna Rogers. I didn't know my grandfather. And so my whole life I have had nothing but Holden stories. I did not come up here for the first time until 1982. Primarily because I was young and didn't think much about a history. And I've been up there, this is my third time. But I finished business college, and I got my first job, and it was at Amex Exploration, and that was in Golden, Colorado. And I'm a receptionist. I mean, you go to college all those years, and then you end up being a receptionist, so go figure. And I am in the break room, and the senior executives are at a table in the corner. And of course, I'm wanting to get my coffee and get back because they're very intimidating. They're very powerful men here. And I'm standing there trying to pour some cream in the coffee, and I hear Holden washing, or I hear Holden about something about holding. And I turn around and I look at the men, and I'm thinking, okay, fine. I said, are you talking about Holden Washington? And about 4 heads went like this at me. And they said, well, yeah, but what would you know about Holden, Washington? And I said, and I said, I was born there. And they said, you were not. I said, really, I was. I was born there. And one of the men was Ray Billman. And I don't know who he was here or what he had to do here. And he goes, well, like, how do I know that? I said, well, my folks were Bob and Gail Davidson. Didn't ring a bell with him. And I'm thinking, okay, next level up is my grandma. And I said, D.A. and Anna Rogers. And he about fell out of his chair. And he said, come with me. And, of course, I'm scared to death because I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. And he marches me down the hall, a very long hall, and in the corner office is, and as I'm going through, I'm noticing that I'm not on this side of the building ever, and there are big nameplates, and I am going into the president's office. I think, oh, my God, I am really in trouble. And he walks in there, and he goes, I have someone here for you to meet. And there's this very tall, slender man with white hair sitting behind this huge desk that must have been like 12 feet long. And he goes, who are you? And Ray Billman says, this is D.A. and Anna Rogers' granddaughter. And that guy looked up and he goes, you're kidding. And he gets on the phone and he gets on the phone and he calls his wife. And it turns out it was Vinton and Thayer Clark. And I wasn't a receptionist very long. So, that's nice.
I'm William Small from fairly early days, the war years. But I want to say, not about what is holding, but what's happened to one of your sons. A man up here by the name of Stanley had a baby boy, same age as my sister Mary, in 1947. He now, I'm sure, has a legacy of Holden because he is producer of a show for the public television station in Spokane called Northwest Profiles. He's been doing this now for, I don't know, 15 years or more, and he's doing little bits and pieces about businesses and people throughout the entire Northwest area, clear up as far as Edmonton, Alberta. I just wanted you to know the success of one of your own.
Okay, everybody's probably wondering why Joy and I are kind of like two peas in a pod. This happened in 1994.
Two.
Okay, 1992. I decided for some unknown reason to stay over an extra night. And usually I would go out, you know, the next day with everybody, but I just wanted to stay overnight and just be by myself, just walk around or whatever. And I go walking down by the post office. Oh, this is, my name's Pat Handel Chandra, and this is Joy Malmstrom.
Ham Malmstrom.
Okay. See, you should. Okay. And I see this lady down there, and she is just as happy as can be. And so I go over there, and she comes up to me, and she says, oh, you're staying over another night? And I said, yes. And she says, well, I saw you with the miners group. And she said, were you with the miners group or were you just visiting, you know, coincidentally? And I said, no, I was with the miners group. And she said, well, I didn't see you that much, but, you know, she recognized me in a way. And she said, I just found where my house was in Winston Camp. And I had this funny feeling. And so we started talking about it. And she asked me where I lived. And I says, I have an idea. Let's just start walking up the road. And when we get to our entrance where our house is, will, you know, turn off. And so we start walking up along the road and we're talking and we're getting a connection. I mean, it was kind of strange in a way. And we walked up the road and we turned on the corner. We went up and we were still talking. We were kind of paying attention where we were going or not. And Joy says, well, we're getting close to my house. And I said, yeah, we're getting close to mine. And we kept talking, kept walking up the road, and we both turned at the same
same time, the same direction. And come to find out, her father constructed the house that my mom and dad eventually bought 10 years later. And we've had that, I don't know, we've just got a real special relationship. And then Herb has taken some pictures, and everybody says, is that your sister? Yeah. You're going to cry, aren't you?
No.
You got anything to add to it?
No, I don't really have anything to add to the story, but from that time on, Pat and I have stayed in close contact. We talk on the phone, we email, and sometimes something is going on, and I get an email, and she'll say, what's the matter? I know something's happening. And she seems to think because we drank the same water. But anyway, we've been friends ever since that time. And I had the pictures that were taken when my dad was building our house. And then Pat had pictures when she and her family lived in the house. And there were some changes. We just had a little vent in the upstairs area where when Pat lived there, she had a window so she could let the chipmunks in.
I guess another thing about Joy is we were walking up the road and we were talking about, you know, our families and stuff like that, and we discovered that both our fathers were carpenters. Dad took over for Eli Dragoo doing plumbing and carpentry work and maintenance work up here. And then we got a little bit deeper, and as we both pack rocks around in our pockets to take them home, even if they weigh us down, we have to crawl home. And it's just amazing how much alike we are, and that's where it must be the water came in. Because it's so similar. Okay, thank you.
I'm Mike Dolphy, and I was here from 39 to 53, and I'll tell a story about on the family. Think about how you got your school clothes, what you did before you need dressed up and how to go to school. The parents decided to take us all four kids to Chelan to go shopping for school clothes. Well, we were pretty rambunctious four kids. We were used to running around doing what we wanted to do. Got down on the boat, went to JCPenney's. Oh, what's this? Run up and down the halls, pulling clothes off, looking at this. Embarrassed my mom so bad, she took us back on a boat, and 4 years later, we got to go back to Chelan. Another one is talking about the fishing in Dumkey Lake. And think about how they got some of the boats to Dumkey Lake. There's no road. So my dad and grandfather being carpenters and a lot of the other guys helped build boats. They build a boat. And how'd they get the boat to the lake? Well, Mr. Trainer here had horses. And they did it two ways. One way, they put a boat between some probably 4x4s or 2x2s, and it carried the boat up. Another one was that was too hard to work. So he thought about it, and probably a couple more beers. They put a wheel in the front of it, nailed on some handles on the back of it, got a horse, and pulled it up. And there were boats, Dumkey Lake and the Heart Lake. And that's how he did it. So that's kind of neat. So, in fact, I'm going to guess that some of the skeletons of the boats are still there in Dumkey Lake. They used to have a shed over them. I think there's about 4 boats to 6 boats with a shelter on them, and over a period of time, the snow collapsed the roofs and the mine closed down. And I was up there in, I think the last time was 63, and there were still see some skeletons of the ribs and stuff of the boat in the water where they were stored. And I was up in July and went to look for them in the Heart Lake, and it was, I didn't know exactly where they were, just too big of an area to search. But anyway, that's a couple of stories. Thank you.
Jerry's mud story made me think of one more It was early May, but it was really hot, and it was a week. It must have been a Saturday, but the ore trucks were running. And my dad had a little putt-putt boat down at Lucerne, and he was going to go down and work on the boat. So Bev Hepscher and Larissa Yates and I rode our bicycles down, and we're going to then bring them back up in the pickup, back in. And we were down there. He was over working on the boat, and it was really hot that day, and the creek was running. And there was that area at that time, of course the creeks changed, but where there was a back, well, the water backed up, it was kind of a swimming hole. But since it was spring, it was just all kinds of, it was full of all kinds of chunks of wood chips and stuff like that. But it was really, really hot. So I went over and asked, we went over and asked Dad if we could go swimming in our clothes. And he said, there's no way I can tell you girls you can go swimming in your clothes. Your mothers will kill me if you go swimming in your clothes. So... But he said, of course, I'm over here working on the boat. I can't see what you're doing over there. So we went swimming in our clothes, which was fine, except that we forgot about the fact that we were going to have to ride in the back end of the pickup going back up the hill. And the ore trucks were running. So think about us in our wet clothes riding in the back of the pickup, and you know how much dust they kick up. Do you think our mothers figured out what we did? Mud balls. My dad was in a lot of hot water.
I'm Joanna Paulson Miller, and Jerry's my brother, and Rayma's my sister. And in the last years, as I recall, we had a ski hill with a rope tow, and there was some kind of cabin there, and our mothers would send goodies there. My mom always sent her caramel rolls or her sticky rolls, and others sent cookies and all this stuff, and there was hot chocolate, and you could ski and then come in, and for just a few cents, you could buy this stuff, and the big roaring fire, and oh, it was just really fun to be there. But I was too small to ride the rope tow by myself. So my big brother Jerry would get in position to grab the rope tow, and he'd spread his legs out, and I'd squat down underneath and grab his knees, and up we'd go, about halfway up, he would let me off, and then I would ski down and wait for him to come down from farther up, and back up we'd go. And I also, is this true, Jerry, they played polka music? I remember polka music coming out. It was so wonderful. Just, we had the best time, and everybody's just skiing away, and you could go into the lodge and get warm. It was just really a fun, fun time.
This is the last one, then I got to go to bed. I'm tired. But, second to last one, I got to tell you a funny story. The Boy Scouts, Jim Sullivan and the Boy Scouts built that cabin. We split the rails for it, and we split the shakes for it, and the only thing that we bought that we didn't make were the nails that held it together and the drop sash windows that had two drop sash windows in it and the door. And Jim was the designer, the ramrod, the overseer, and we built that in the summertime. And it was, you could stay in that at night, be in it at night on a rainy night, and you could look through the roof. And that's when I learned that you can look through it, you can see stars through a shake roof, and it won't leak. You won't get wet. And it's something about the shakes, the way the water runs down them or something. But Joanna's right. We had a big, the blacksmith shop made us a big stove to go in there, and we split our own wood, and it was so nice. We'd ski up there until 10, 11 o'clock at night, or until the tow motor would run out of gas or the rope would break, and then come in there and warm up and drink hot chocolate. And we had tons of, I remember just lots of cookies. I don't really remember the sticky rolls, but I remember lots of cookies. And you'd put a quarter in or a nickel or whatever you had, you know, and it was just, that was just absolute heaven for us guys and people that really liked to ski. And there was kids and adults alike that would ski up there late into the evening. And our parents never concerned where we were. If we said, well, I'm going skiing, you know, they knew where we were. And it was a gentle slope To a kid, it was treacherous. But looking at it now, it was barely 2%. But it was really a great place to go up and ski. And Jim Sullivan, a lot of you maybe remember Jim and Marion, his first wife. She had diabetes, and they couldn't have children, but they loved children. And that's why they both spent so much time with the Boy Scouts and the Campfire Girls and just kids in general. And they were really entertaining and very nurturing. And we would go down to the Sullivan's house a month or two before the orthopedic bazaar that was held in this very room. And we would make all kinds of stuff to sell to earn money for the orthopedics, whatever that was. And my mom was really big into that. But I remember skiing up there, and Marion was such a good skier, and she didn't take very good care of herself because she'd come in and drink chocolate, and she'd eat candy bar and cookies and stuff, and she smoked. And she just didn't take care of herself, and I remember when she passed away, it was really devastating. That was, just to finish the story about the ski hill, it wasn't just some old building up there. We built that thing. Now, a lot of you people here won't remember this, and I don't know if this is still true or not, but if you look right up there, there's a hole in the ceiling, and I'll bet you that if we could get up there, I've been up there back when I was a kid, I'll bet you the rocket ship is still up there. Because we had, this was back in like 55 or 56, I don't remember what the competition was, but all the kids had to make some sort of space suit or something. And I remember Alan Anderson got the prize because he had this paper mache thing that went over his head, and it really looked like a space helmet with a screen in front. And I remember Tom's had a World War II helmet. And Al had put an antenna on it with little discs on the antenna and a strap and earphones. My mom always used to buy me these leather hats, leather helmets with the goggles on them. And so I had that, and I had two Kerr jar lids glued onto the sides for earphones. And I can't remember something else on it, but that was my space helmet. But then we had this big space show down here, and right over there, about where Diane is sitting, we came in here, and it was all decorated up and everything, but there was a spaceship there, big silver spaceship, had a red nose on it, and I think it was probably 25 feet high. It was probably 6 feet high. But they went through the whole presentation, and they did the competition, and Alan got his prize, and I didn't get a prize. And then they said, well, it's time to blast off. And the lights shut off all at once, and there was this tremendous explosion of light, not big, not a kind of a boom, but bright light. So, you know, your eyes can't see in the black, and this spaceship disappeared. And I remember having an after image of it being about this high off the floor and gone. It went up through that hole. It had a rope on it. Somebody up there pulled it up through that hole. And it was a year or two later, me and some of my friends, we discovered that in the Bluebird Room up there, there is an access to the upstairs. And when we were exploring, we were on the catwalk up there. It seemed like a long ways down to the floor. But right over here, that spaceship, I'll bet you, is still laying there. I want to go see. But I've already checked, and there's a great big padlock on the door. I want to say that it's just been a really great pleasure for me and my wife to come up here and visit with all you folks and see this place again and walk around and enjoy it. And a lot of the people that were here that I visited with aren't here now. They've gone to bed or whatever. Brad Morgan was here. He was real important in my young life in the church and as a scout master. And I killed his lawn for him. He and his wife went out to vacation. He paid me, was going to pay me to take care of his lawn, and I totally forgot. And so when he came back in, I realized they were in town. I ran up and put a sprinkler on it, but it was about the color of this floor. And that's the only time, I wish he was here to hear this story. I shared it with him earlier, but that's the only time I saw Brad really angry. But he didn't raise his voice, and he didn't swear at me, but he was angry. And I still expected him to pay me, and I think that he did. I'm not sure. But it's been a real pleasure being up here. We're going to be all leaving tomorrow, and I want to thank you all for being here for me. And it's been a real pleasure and a joy visiting and seeing you all. Good night.
Nobody has mentioned about a babysitting story, so I thought I'd tell this one. I'm Helen Small Kristen, and I was a pretty big kid, as you can imagine, being a small. So when I was 10 years old, there weren't very many teenagers here during the wintertime. They were all out going to high school. And since I was a bigger kid than most of them at 10 years old, I guess they felt that I was mature enough to babysit. So in one of the community activities, there was one family who had young children and needed a babysitter. I had no experience at all, of course. My little sister hadn't been born yet. But this woman contacted my mother and asked her if it would be all right if I could come and babysit. Well, she questioned about how old these children were, and she was assured that there were only a couple of them, and they would be in bed and asleep, and all I would have to do is stay there in case the fire started or something, so I could get the kids out. She schooled me on that. So just in case, though, she sent my brother along with me, and we went up. We lived on the bottom row, and this house was clear up on the top row, up the big hill. So I get up there and walk into the house, and I was informed at that time, since there was a scarcity of babysitters, that this other family had decided to add their children to the mix, that they had a baby. But the baby was asleep, and the baby would stay asleep during the whole time they were gone. So they hadn't been gone very long when the baby started to cry. And I thought, what do I do now? So I went and I picked up the baby, and the baby kept crying and crying. And I thought, well, let's see now. Its diaper must be wet. Where are the diapers? I didn't know how to change a diaper. They hadn't told me where any diapers were. So I send my brother down to my mother, down on the bottom row, to see if she could come up with some kind of a solution. So he comes back up with a diaper. I don't know where she found it. And I somehow figured out how to pin a diaper on this child, but still wouldn't stop crying. And I seemed like forever, but it probably wasn't, holding this baby, trying to get it to calm down. That's all I could think of to do. That's as much as I remember. I don't know how the story ended, but I know I survived. And I had a little sister 2 years later, and then I really learned how to change a diaper.
My name is Dale Riggs, and my folks were Everett and Ruby Riggs, and my brother Joe's here. And we lived up here in Holden since 42, and after I graduated from eighth grade up here in 43, well, I went out to high school and then came up in the summer times, and I got married in 1950, and we made our home up here, and I was working up here, and By 56, why, we had three boys, and it was awfully inconvenient to go any place out in Chelan or in Wenatchee and get around. So I decided I better get a car, and I'd never learned to drive, and anyway, I went over to Seattle to see an uncle over there, and I told him I was interested in getting a car, and he said, well, let's go down and look at the Ford dealers. He was a Ford man, and so we went down there, and we found a 55 Ford ranch wagon, a standard shift. Of course, I couldn't drive it, and so made arrangements to get the car, and got one of the salesmen to go. I went with him, family went with him back to Wenatchee. And then I had an uncle in Wenatchee, and he drove it up to Chelan for me. And they loaded it on, eventually they put it on the barge and brought it up to Lucerne, and I got somebody up there to bring it up to Holden, and I learned to drive, or thought I would learn to drive it, on the road up here. And one day, the wife and I and our three children, and we picked up Winnie Meredith, I'm sure that you knew him, and his wife, and he had two children. And we all got in the station wagon, and I drove down to Lucerne there. We stopped at the tavern, and Winnie and I went in to get some a beer apiece, and we got some soft drinks for the kids and the wives, and came back out and got in the car. And if I remember right, it was a stubby beer, probably an Ole or something, and I stuck it down between my legs. It was open. And I got in there. We started to go, and I had it on low gear, and it jerked on me, and my foot went down the gas, and I hit three garbage cans close to the building and caught the corner of the building there on the tavern, made an awful racket, and all the people come running out of the tavern, coming out and started laughing, carrying on, you know, and of course they got a hold of the front end of my car and bounced it over, and we went ahead and drove up on the switchbacks then, and finished our drink up on the switchbacks up before we drove back over. But I don't think I spilled a drop of beer either, so.
My name is Diane Sisko Recknagel. And I thought maybe we could share a few doctor stories up here. The first one I remember is when Dr. Heron was up here, when we first moved here. And my sister and her family lived here, and she had a little three-year-old girl. And she proceeded to pull boiling water over her chest. And Dr. Heron treated it by putting a cast on the child from the neck down to the waist, a total little cast. And weeks later, whatever it was, finally took it off, and the child didn't have any scars, just a little red mark. And I had never heard of that before or never heard of it since. The next doctor, I believe, was Dr. Miller and his wife, Marie. And they were wonderful people and became good friends of ours. And Marie was from New England, I think probably New York area. And she was an RN and had practiced and been tutored in natural birth methods. And so here was a perfect opportunity to try this, because one of the things that Dr. Miller did want to do when he come up here, and the company agreed, was to deliver babies and do minor surgeries and things. And so we started our tutoring, and Marie tutored me in natural birth, which apparently seems to be popular again. And it was kind of a self-hypnosis thing. And so I had two children up here that way. And it's a wonderful method, and I went out and had two more in the same method with new doctors, and had to explain to them that this is how we do it, and it works, and it's wonderful. One of the things I remember with the child, the firstborn, was Don changed diapers, and he got this infection. And so he goes down to Dr. Miller, and Dr. Miller looks at him and said, "You've been changing diapers, haven't you?" And he said, "No more of that," which made Don most happy. They were a lovely family. They moved on down to California and had four girls. And if any of you remember them, they had a Charity and a Constance and a Christine. And a Candace. Good. Yeah, they're a very nice family. Does anyone else have any doctor stories? Because there was always a doctor, I think the company, it was required for their insurance purposes, And the hospital was always more of a first aid station until I think either Dr. Heron or Dr. Miller came here. And then there were babies born here. Probably, Linda, about 10 or 12 of them. I think the children that were born here take great pride in being born here. And I know we have a daughter who is really specified that her ashes someday will be at Holden. And matter of fact, she came up many, many years ago before there was an awful lot going on here. And she went into the hospital and... which is now converted to apartments. She went into the hospital, and there in this room with the gurney, with the stirrups, with the lights and everything was just exactly like, I'm sure, like it was when she was born. So, thank you.